You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Explore Ithaca's waterfalls, orchards, and craft beverage scene. Plan your getaway at visitithaca.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today we're talking about seaweed. Don't ask me why. Well, I have a good reason why. The reason is that I have another show. I know, I'm sorry. I do. I have a local show in Rhode Island, and I interviewed a local sugar kelp farmer, and he was so fantastic that I'm bringing him to my other audience, which is all y'all. And this farmer's name is Jonathan McGee. He's a sugar kelp farmer, and he is also one of the founders of the New England Sugar Kelp Cooperative. So Jonathan, you have other very interesting and appropriate background, which doesn't pertain necessarily to aquaculture, but which certainly helps you when it comes to publicizing your product. So didn't you come from like a marketing background or something like that? I sort of vaguely remember that from our previous conversation.
Yes. Hi, good morning, Katie. Awesome to be here. And thank you for the intro. I hope I'm as interesting as last time. That could have just been one in a million.
I doubt it.
So my background is I work in the packaging industry. I have a career in the packaging industry that's close to three decades long now, and that is primarily sales and marketing with some engineering to begin with.
Wow, you didn't look that old, Jonathan.
I eat seaweed. What can I say?
The food of the gods and goddesses, as we will discuss a future part of this interview. So first of all, why don't you tell us about what is the New England Sugar? It's not even called the New England Sugar Kelp Cooperative.
It's actually called the Sugar Kelp Cooperative.
Right.
And you could be confusing it because our website is www.newenglandkelp.com.
That is why I'm confused. Yes.
That'll do it. So it is the Sugar Kelp Cooperative. We are based in Stonington, Connecticut. And what the cooperative does is it serves as a buyer of sugar kelp from Southern New England kelp farms. Also serves as a distributor for the product. And both in non-processed forms and processed forms, serves as a processor for the products, and also serves as a marketing entity to sell all these products, and most importantly, to grow the industry in general.
Right. So, how did you get into the kelp farming business? I'm not even sure I remember that I asked you that before. What prompted you to get into it? And then we'll talk about how it's grown and why it should be grown.
You know, it's kind of funny, I think, because when I consider how much time and energy and passion I have toward all of this, the introduction was me watching TV.
Oh, so, well.
I guess that's one of those times where maybe TV can be beneficial.
Right.
Despite what we were told growing up. But yes, yeah, so I stumbled upon a 60 minutes story on sugar kelp farming in the Long Island Sound in Connecticut with Green Wave, who is a nonprofit entity in Connecticut that is a major contributor to the technological and other growths of the industry. And so I saw that story and became very excited right away.
Right. So how do you start a kelp farm? Like how do you start with a seed, with clones? You have to get permits. I mean, it's kind of a process, right? Like it's easy once you get started, but the getting started part, like that seems like
the two biggest obstacles, I would say, to starting a kelp farm. One, the regulatory challenges or hurdles or requirements that you navigate. And then secondly, it's the costs, and the largest cost is a boat. So that was a barrier that I had already cleared because I had a boat. And
how big a boat? Does it have to be like a big motorboat, like a 26 footer, or you know, or can it really be a rowboat?
You know, it all depends on where the site is. It depends on, you know, on how large the farm is, how many people you'll have on the boat. My farm is about a half mile from shore, and the water conditions are relatively mild in terms of currents primarily, and exposure to, you know, to really rough conditions, although the exposure is still there. And I say relatively because there are cases where people will grow in deep ocean water, and in those cases you'll often have much stronger currents and you need a big boat
for that, right?
Right. And so for me on my site, I actually do everything right now with a 20-foot center console fishing boat.
Uh-huh.
It's actually been working out really well. It's as I continue to scale, it will I'll have to get a different boat. But that's been great so far. So the process, you know, to getting all the permitting and everything is in Connecticut, it's about roughly a year long process, maybe a little less. And it's several steps. I don't even know how many steps. It's a lot. and the reason is that you end up engaging with any and every stakeholder that's involved. And a stakeholder in this case is, by my definition, anybody who has an opinion on the matter.
All right.
So in Connecticut, it actually works out pretty well because you reach out to the Department of Agriculture's Aquaculture Division, and they end up being your quarterback, so to speak, throughout the process. So you end up working with numerous other entities, Army Corps of Engineers, Department of Environment and Energy Protection, Department of Consumer Protection, local shellfish entities, local municipalities, all these things. But the Department of Agriculture helps guide you through all this, which works out really well.
Yeah. Well, I saw when I was doing research for this show, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit since we're talking about regulatory issues, that was really a very significant hurdle that the industry as a whole is facing. This was from your GreenWave, your pals at GreenWave, which is the tech assistance nonprofit you mentioned earlier. And that they are, I guess, trying to work with legislators to streamline some of those regulatory hurdles, it sounds like. So it's getting the permit is the hardest thing, it sounds like. And then let me say that again. It sounds like, no, Jesus. Like I said, I've been inside a little too long this last few days. but then the other stuff is like, you have to find the capital. The capital would be the boat investment, but then also the infrastructure on which you grow the kelp. Are there entities, USDA grants, district grants that can help you with that? And then how do you find, like, I know with shellfishing aquaculture, it's they're very strict about the permitting. Is it a similar scenario for kelp farming?
So they are very strict. They are very strict. So shellfish is sort of, in a lot of ways, the most important crop around here anyway to regulate, and I'd imagine that's universal because how it's handled is so critical, and where it's grown is critical.
Equally critical, yeah.
Correct. And so in Connecticut, our regulatory standards mirror that of shellfish standards, shellfishing standards. So in Connecticut, to grow sugar, and by the way, Connecticut won't allow sugar kelp to be used for human consumption in any other way than grown than cultivated on long lines. So you can't take wild stock as an example.
Right. Well, that makes sense. Otherwise, there would be no more kelp because people would just rip off all the wild stock, right?
It something like that, yeah. And it's a big problem.
Sure.
Or it would be a big problem. Since it's all grown in unconditionally approved shellfish waters. So in Connecticut, we have different categories for the shellfish beds and the shellfish areas, and they're conditionally approved and unconditionally approved. And conditionally approved means that they're usually open, but if there are environmental factors that come into play, and the biggest one is if there's a ton of rain that comes down and you have a lot of drain into the Sound,
a lot of stormwater drain off, which typically means that sewage systems have overflown and you're getting a very high bacteria count, which is why they close beaches to swimming and why they close shellfish beds to shellfishing. So, but it surprises me that kelp would also absorb some of those toxins and maintain them within their cellular structure.
Well, as far as maintaining them, that I don't know. I do know that as far as bacteria goes, one of the requirements in Connecticut is that your farm has to be tested every year for bacteria, heavy metals, and a few other things before you're given your license to sell for the year.
I understand. Well, I mean, the heavy metals make sense to me because they would draw that up through their roots, just like rice draws up arsenic, for instance.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Heavy metals is a big concern, and as far as bacteria, and then storm runoff and all of that. The kelp farms are only in the unconditionally approved or the, always open shellfish beds because they're in further out sites that won't be affected by storm runoff.
Okay.
And so it's those sites that we grow. I'm sorry. Maybe I've been inside too long too. Those are the sites we grow sugar kelp in the state of Connecticut.
I see. So, let's talk a little bit about just sort of the nuts and bolts, and then in the next, because we're going to take a little short break, like literally a minute, and then we'll talk more about sort of like the whole processing infrastructure, all that stuff. So just to be clear, say you've got your boat, you get your permit, you buy your seeds or your clones. Like, how do you plant kelp? I mean, let's get nitty gritty here, Jonathan. Like, I didn't get this. We've talked so, wildly in one direction after another in the last iteration that I didn't really get the process. So I like to know the manufacturing process of anything. And this is just another product. So do you plant seeds in the ocean floor? And then you basically run like a clothesline, right? Or something like that.
Yeah. So picture a clothesline, like, just a simple, simple old school backyard clothesline, two poles coming out of the ground, one string connecting them. So imagine that in the water, where your clothesline, in this case, it's your grow line, your long line for the kelp is going to be about a meter below the surface of the water. And we utilize seed that is embedded on strings. We call it seed string.
Uh-huh.
And seed string is created in tanks. There are a few hatcheries that produce this. And for most everybody in southern New England, it comes from GreenWave in Connecticut. And essentially, GreenWave is able to provide us with spools of seed string that have, well, string that has seeds, about 200 linear feet per spool.
How many plants does that represent? Like, how many seeds can they put on 200 feet?
That is a question I cannot answer.
Okay, never mind then.
But I'd imagine they get as many on there as they can. Right. And there's going to be a lot in the beginning that aren't visible to the naked eye. And
I see. Cause it's really, it truly probably microscopic when they send it to you.
Yeah. Well, and then some you'll see it starting to grow. So you take this seed string and you wrap it around your long line and secure it and wait for it to grow
and then make sure sit back and wait, what, 6 months?
Yeah, outplanting ideally for me is the week leading up to Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And you start harvesting, really, you start harvesting in April.
Okay.
Finishing up in late May for the most part.
Uh-huh. And it's one season. It's like, that's it. It takes 6 months. You can't like start another crop in May and then harvest that in November. Is that right? It's a one-shot deal.
Correct. Yeah. So sugar kelp is only grown in the winter because, you know, it will grow all year round and we see it all year round. But in the winter, there's none of the organisms that are around in the warmer seasons attack it. And so that's why it's important for it to be the winter. In Connecticut, the only seaweed that we are allowed to grow is sugar kelp. So at this point, there's an off season with seaweed cultivation, and if we get to the point where we're cultivating, dulse would be a good one to add, or another local seaweed, then we might be able to, alternate the crop as the calendar progresses.
Right. Although it's very convenient that your harvest time coincides basically with the opening of the fishing season, right? Because that's somewhere around March, April. We're going to take a short break, but I interviewed a couple of fishermen last week, actually. And they were very disparate. They were saying, well, these windmills going in are going to wreck the fishing. This industrial fish, aquaculture, fin fish like salmon in open water, which I'm very much against. But that's obviously coming. And then they mentioned industrial kelp farming. And I'm wondering, is that different from what you're doing? Is that something else? Or are they just not really understanding that your season is over when their season begins? Like, why would they object to, large scale kelp farming? I was curious about that.
All right. So I have to say that it's the first time I've ever heard of an objection like that.
I know, right?
So we've heard of objections in the past where particularly, shoreline homeowners would be concerned about what the aesthetics would look like.
Yeah,
and that was easy to alleviate because everything is happening below the surface of the water. You only see some buoys on the top of the water. As far as those comments from the fishermen, I mean, one, I just have to say it doesn't sound like they,
know a lot about it.
Doesn't sound like they know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Okay.
And the words strung together, industrial kelp farming, that's also the first time I've heard those together because I think all I could imagine is, I hear their concerns on fin fish farms and I share many of those concerns and probably many of the concerns you have. Windmills, I not a big expert on that. But as far as, kelp farming presenting issues to anybody I just can't imagine what they're talking about. One thing about kelp and about kelp farms is that you're creating a much healthier water column.
Yeah.
So you end up giving fish more to eat, and you give, you know, the stuff fish eat more to eat. And you're also removing nitrogen and carbon from the water. So near our farms, you'll see an increase in different species. You'll see more fish hanging around. You'll see more lobsters. It ends up having a really positive effect. I guess I could see a concern if they're using nets or something, and they have to go around a kelp farm or something.
Maybe that's what he was talking about. Let's take a short break because I want to come back and talk more thoroughly about the environmental benefits of kelp farming kelp. And then we'll keep talking about the regulatory and processing and stuff. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Jonathan McGee from Sugar Kelp Farm Cooperative in New England. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca, helping you to plan your next getaway. Ithaca has waterfalls and wineries, art and theater, outdoor recreation, and family fun. The area is famous for its glacier-carved gorges, co-op-run businesses, and cultural influences from Cornell University and Ithaca College. The area is well known for its local cideries, which are leading the way in America's cider revival. You can hear from the region's cider makers directly on HRN's series Hardcore. There is something really special about Ithaca's climate for cultivating delicious apples steeped in history and terroir. The second season of Hardcore is out now. You can learn all about apples and fermentation and dive into how cider makers and their communities are working to create an equitable industry and one that is resilient to climate change. Listen to Hardcore on your favorite podcast app.
HRN is home to transformative exchanges about food. We hope our diverse lineup of shows opens your eyes, educates, and empowers.
Thanks to HRN, I ventured into the world of cooking with sumac, and I have not looked back since.
I was listening to A Taste of the Past with my mom, and there was an episode about the history of American food. It inspired me to make it the subject of my final social studies project, and I ended up getting an A.
Join us during our summer membership drive by donating and becoming a member. Members play an essential role in keeping nonprofit food radio on the air. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member today. We thank you for your support.
So, anyway, we were talking about the environmental benefits of farming kelp, and you mentioned that it increases the habitat for fish and for fish breeding, right? And it's, one thing is it sequesters carbon, right?
Correct.
So, and on the Green Wave site, they were saying kelp cultivation is a tool to sequester carbon, but how do they measure that? Or something I read. And I'm going to ask you that too, because I know that this is also an issue when it comes to sequestering carbon off of farms. Like everybody talks about how great it's going to be when farmers can get paid for the carbon that they sequester, but nobody has really come up, as I understand it, and I, you know, somebody out there can prove me wrong, but I am not aware that there is a reliable tool to actually make those measurements and measurements that are reliable enough that one can then extrapolate a value, a monetary value that could be paid to a kelp farmer as it would be paid to a terrestrial farmer. So I wondered if you could comment on that.
Yeah, it's a great topic, and it's very important, obviously, for stakeholders everywhere. It's important for the environment, it's important for the farmers. And so there are sort of two areas that I look at with this. It's the way you can measure it, the way you could quantify how much carbon is coming in. And then the second one is government agreement on what that means, what it means to pulling the carbon out, and what happens if you change the kelp or the product, and are you then releasing some of the carbon back?
Right.
So on the first part, there's been a lot of work, and there is a ton of work going on right now to be able to quantify how much kelp is being sequestered. We're definitely getting there. This year, for the first time, even though it's not an exact science yet, GreenWave actually paid farmers for exactly that, basically for carbon credits. Not to the extent financially that it will be, but what they did basically, and I didn't get this from them, I just surmised it myself. They basically said, listen, we know it's doing it. We know we'll get there with all the measurement tools and everything. And that'll be very important. Right now, these farmers need some extra help, you know, keeping afloat so we can keep all of this going and all the values that it has. So they did, pay farmers this year for sequestering carbon. The other part that's tricky, as I understand it, is what does it mean to sequester carbon? So if you could measure how much carbon has been sequestered in, say, one blade of kelp, you have a number. But then what happens if that kelp is then put somewhere else or in another form where it's utilized, and then arguably the carbon or some of the carbon is no longer sequestered.
Right.
And so that's something that's being tackled right now too. There's an effort in Northern New England right now where a program where these folks, and this is very cool, these folks are going far offshore, cultivating large amounts of kelp for the sole purpose of just dropping it to the bottom of the ocean after
Really?
It's grown. And the reason for that is it's at a depth which will keep it from breaking down and arguably releasing the carbon. So they're sequestering the carbon, dropping it down to the bottom of the seafloor in an area where it will remain that way.
Uh-huh.
And so that's, you know, one of the short-term and maybe short and long-term answers to that question. But those are the two things. I mean, just overall, we are getting there, and it's exciting. Obviously, when we get there, it'll be really exciting.
Right, right. What about like processing? I mean, you just mentioned that, like, how much carbon are you releasing when you process kelp? First of all, what kind of infrastructure? Most kelp is sown, as I understand it, most kelp is sold fresh as a fresh product or maybe blanched. But as far as like drying it, powdering it, turning it into some other application, how much infrastructure exists for that? And is that like one of the bigger hurdles to becoming, say, a large scale kelp farmer?
That is one of the biggest hurdles, yes. It's a big hurdle in Southern New England. It's a big hurdle everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why my partner and I created the Sugar Kelp Cooperative, was to be able to tackle that collectively and lead that charge.
Right.
So, there's not much existing infrastructure. We do have some processing equipment right now for limited scale, and certainly we are making plans to be able to expand. But the infrastructure has been a big challenge, and then it's, you know, and part of it is, you know, where is the market going? What kind of infrastructure is needed for the products that the market is looking for? So we sell fresh, untouched, unprocessed kelp for a short window of time during the harvest season. So say, April and May, we're able to provide, fresh kelp. But after that, it'll be processed in some way or another. And whether it's simply frozen just to maintain its shelf life, or if it's put into a powder and put into another product that becomes an ingredient in in a soup or something like that. So that's one of the areas that we're learning as we go and as the market grows is where to invest the processing dollars. Are you doing it in drying equipment? Are you doing it in flash freezing? Are you doing it in filling equipment? What are the best solutions?
Sure. I wonder how much Americans are ready to embrace kelp as a food source. Like, you're selling it primarily into restaurants, right? And, it's great when you have a fabulous chef who's able to, turn it into something dazzling. But for the average American, who maybe isn't familiar with eat or doesn't want to eat sushi, isn't familiar with eating seaweed as a delicious, healthy snack or addition to your, dinner table, how are we going to sell them? How are you, Jonathan, Mr. Marketing Packaging Man? what is your vision for getting Americans to recognize that this is a great food source and that it should be? And then I want to talk also about other added value products that can be made with kelp. But let's start with, changing American tastes.
Yeah. So, when I first started my farm and I first brought a crop about and I said, okay, this is all going perfectly. And okay, all right, everybody buy the kelp. And, and it's just crickets. So to answer the question about are Americans ready for it, my answer would be they're either excited for it at this point, or they haven't been introduced to it yet. And of course, there's going to be a percentage that will fall out of that. But I think, that is where most people are. And I say that because, from the marketing aspect, the Sugar Kelp Cooperative created a project which turned out to be very successful. And now it's an annual event, and it's called the New England Kelp Harvest Week.
Right.
And it's essentially a restaurant week, about a week and a half really, where the restaurants are utilizing fresh local sugar kelp and putting that into different dishes that they're introducing to all of their customers. And, we came up with that. We knew it would work. We've seen other people do some similar things. And obviously, we've seen, restaurants are such a great way to promote things.
Sure.
So our first one was in 2021, early spring of 2021, and we had some really good success. We had 40 something restaurants/markets/breweries that participated, and they were able to roll it out to their customers, and the response was really positive.
Great.
And then we did it this year. It was that much easier to get the restaurants that were involved the first year. Almost all of them were involved this past year as well, or this year rather. Getting new restaurants to come on was that much easier than it was the previous year.
Sure.
And then the effect that is having on, getting out to the market, so families are learning about it. And we see it in just social media activity and there are definitely, quantifiable market trends. And, we come up with some fancy graphs once in a while, based on what we've seen. But it's working, it's getting there. And I say that people are either excited or enthusiastic about it, or they haven't been introduced to it yet because there is excitement to it. Because once somebody eats it or has it as part of a drink or something, and they say, wow, this is actually really good. I had no idea. So then it's something they're interested in eating, and they probably have an idea that it's very healthy. And then you learn more about the nutritional values and you say, okay, this stuff is amazing. It truly is. And then you let people know what the environmental benefits are to sugar kelp. And those are significant, you know. So sugar kelp is a regenerative crop.
Right.
So it grows without the need for, you know, arable land, fresh water. That's a squeaky chair, by the way, that I'm on right now.
That's all right.
All right. Just want to make that very clear. So requires no fertilizer, no, you know, pesticides, herbicides, you know, whatever. I mean, it's all it needs to grow is the water that it's in and the sun that's coming down. That is it. And in the process of growing, like we touched on earlier, it's sequestering carbon. It's pulling nitrogen out of the water, and as a species, we talk about carbon all the time, as we should. Nitrogen in the water columns is a massive, massive issue, and sure, that leads to ocean acidification, and, you know, leads to dead zones
eutrophication deprives all the oxygen out of the thing. Let me ask you this, because we don't have too much time left, Jonathan, and I just want people to understand, aside from the nutritive values, because it truly is a superfood, and the obvious environmental benefits, there are a lot of other applications for kelp. Like as somebody who follows the livestock industry regularly and for a decade now, I know that there's been a lot of talk about incorporating seaweed into, you know, cattle feed because it reduces their emissions, their gas emissions. They quit farting as much. I mean, are there other, like, is that, for example, being embraced by livestock producers that, oh, wow, here is a way that we can, like, both maybe reduce our feed costs and also provide an environmental benefit? Like, is there any talk of that kind of thing? And or is it also something that could be, like, mushrooms converted into packaging that is more, user or environmentally friendly, or pharmaceutical products because of its high nutritional values? I'm just trying to get at some of the other applications for this product.
Yeah. So yes to all of the above.
Right.
Yes to all the above. And the, you know, the studies that have taken place with livestock feed fortified with kelp have been really encouraging. And that's something where basically the studies are showing that if cattle is fed with kelp or kelp fortified feed, that their methane emissions are reduced by, there's one study that had it at 90%.
Come on.
But it's always in like the 70% and north area. So right. I think there's a good argument to be made for picking and choosing spots to eat beef, partially because it does have a massive footprint. It has a massive carbon footprint, and there are a lot of environmental concerns. And the biggest, or I would say the biggest, not an expert, but is the methane emission. And if you cut that by 75%. I mean, I'm probably going to eat another steak or two.
Yeah, right. I mean, I would be marketing this so hard to livestock feed companies, you know, that produce all the, basically the pharmaceuticals that livestock get when they're in the feedlot. I mean,
well, and what I could tell you, and so as far as my interactions with, you know, staying on the kelp for livestock feed, my interactions with the large national houses that, you know, produce beef are non-existent. But the conversations I've had with local beef farmers is very positive, and they are all over it. And I point that out because there's a lot of switching to eating locally cultivated foods.
Sure.
It's one of the, and that's an example of one of the reasons it's very helpful. So when you do come up with something, you could start implementing it much faster.
True. Absolutely. Well, I'm going to off the show, I'm going to look into some of these various companies that I'm familiar with and see if they have thought about this or are they getting educated? I mean, I would even get into like university extension schools and you know, co-ops, farm co-ops to say like, hey, you guys, here's a low cost additive to your feed that could have a huge impact. Plus, what about the nutritional benefits? It's not like it's only people who absorb minerals and so on from kelp. It's animals too, right? I mean,
to be 100%. And right now, you know, on a large scale, my understanding is you know, just running the tests and capturing all the data. But I do know, you know, for example, UConn and Penn State have a collaborative study going on to, you know, for exactly this. And there are a lot of entities that are diving into this because it is, you know, the potential is so huge. I mean, drop the methane emissions by a significant amount while utilizing a regenerative crop. I mean, there's just so many winners lined up in that.
Absolutely.
The winners that don't include some of the big agra that's responsible for supplying them food right now.
Right. Well, once they figure it out, believe me, they'll be hiring you to grow their kelp for them.
They are not stupid.
We're going to wrap it up there, Jonathan. Thank you so much for this. The tagline for your organization is "Let's eat like gods and goddesses." People, check out New England. What does it tell again? What is it? The New England Kelp.
So and the website is newenglandkelp.com.
Yeah. So check that out. And
what I will say, just jump in really quick. We have a lot of new things happening the second half of this year.
Great.
2023 is going to be a transformative year for us. I would, and anybody who's interested in keeping tabs on it, just go to our website, newenglandkelp.com, and just sign up for the newsletter, and we'll keep everybody posted.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time today. It's been great talking to you again, Jonathan. I enjoy it so much.
You as well, Katie. A pleasure.
Thank you, folks, for tuning in. We'll be back next week. Have a great week. And thanks to our sponsors, as always, for supporting the show and all the shows on Heritage Radio Network. So long for now.
What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.